Welcome back, users, to the Sucks Podcast. I am your host and audio editor, Dave. Thank you so much for letting us splice this into two episodes, because I really needed the sleep, as you could tell. Okay, but here we are. We're on the eve of Election Day, so you have one more day to vote, all right? So get to it. Until then, I want you to listen to the rest of this episode. We've got solutions, your favorite part of the show. We're going to solve voting. And before that, we've got an extra special guest interview that you're not going to want to miss. So without further ado, let's jump back into the episode.
All right. Well, solutions. You've already kind of tiptoed into some solutions into the waiting.
Well, no, Band-Aids first, right?
Oh, Band-Aids? Okay, sure.
Yeah, because Band-Aids are, I define Band-Aids as things we could do right now, right? These are things we could do right now. Solutions are like, somebody do this, make this happen. So what is the second Band-Aid you got, Brad?
I don't think I wrote most of these, so if anybody else wants to take one.
Okay, so voting early by mail, that's another Band-Aid. Joe talked a lot about that.
If you can.
Not voting on stuff you don't understand, which I hate to. I will do that. So I don't know a judge, I don't vote, and then I'm so mad at myself in the voting booth. When I mail it, I don't do that. I always vote for it, but it's in a pinch. I can't, in my conscience, because I might be voting the wrong way.
Right.
Nonpartisan guides like PolitiFact. All right. So these are Band-Aids are vote early, vote often. Just kidding. Vote early. Read, like, look at these voter guides and
maybe fight the apathy. I mean,
that's pretty it. That's pretty much it. Yeah. So let's get into solutions, Brad. Let's dream big.
Dream big. Okay. First, let's identify what problem we are ultimately trying to solve with solutions. So here we go. And hopefully, it wouldn't be great. We've already touched on this. Like, if as a country, we could agree with what I'm about to say. I believe we need more people to participate and for everyone to have faith in the electoral system.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Wouldn't that be great? Yes, that's what problem we're trying to solve ultimately. So that's the hardest thing. You know, we can't lose faith and hope, even though it might be perfectly reasonable for us to do that. We can't. We just can't.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. So these are very philosophical. These are very like emotional, like, yes, believe in voting, believe in democracy, believe in the system. But what about tactical, practical? I want to talk about online voting because you guys know I love this.
Sure.
Okay.
Online voting.
I really think because going back to my killer app, right? Mm-hmm. You can see the extension of that. I have all the information. I know how to vote. I have my voter guides. I have everything there in that app. I can do it simple or I can get granular. Then the key would be I could then go and actually cast my vote in the same app, right? Mm-hmm. I could do this anytime. I could do it while I'm on the toilet. I could do it at work. I could do it in traffic, you know, at a stoplight, not while you're driving. That would be amazing. But what is the problem with that, Joe or Brad? What is the problem with online voting?
Well, there's practically no adoption to it worldwide as it stands. So in my research, here's what I found. I found that some Swiss citizens who are expatriated from Switzerland can vote by internet. So that's a very niche group of people within one small country who can vote by internet. Some smaller elections, it's important to note, have vote by internet in France, but only for the small elections, not for major or presidential elections in France.
Okay.
Finland ran a trial in 2008 where they had online voting. As part of the trial, they had a subsequent study. They ruled that the risk outweighed the benefits of online voting in Finland.
So there it is. That's the answer I wanted, Brad, is the risks, the security measures. Mm-hmm. So as I do, I don't think about any of that stuff. I go right to the solutions. And then I say, people who know what they're talking about, you figure it out. So yes, we need to figure out security, but the voting needs to move online and it needs to be like solid, rock solid, quantum encryption. I don't know what that means, but you know what I mean. It needs to be transparent, bulletproof.
Sure.
There's no way to corrupt it.
Well, that's a good transition point into the blockchain. You know, I've been struggling, you know, ever since the blockchain has become ubiquitous in the past few years to come up with practical applications for how you can use blockchain for the betterment of the world, because it's not NFTs, right? So blockchain voting, I think, is a real potential solution for how we could do this in a secure way.
Yeah. And Brad, you interviewed an expert, the expert, right? Is that too much to say? The expert in blockchain voting. Somebody's on the forefront of this. Do you want to do it? Should we queue up that interview?
Let's queue up the interview, then we'll come back. This is a great conversation. All right. With us today is Jamie Skella, the founder, UX genius, and digital disruptor in the real estate market, investment, and voting backgrounds. He is chief customer officer at Osco, formerly the head of UX at the Australian Football League, which is super cool, the founder of Horizon State, which has done some very innovative work on blockchain voting. And Jamie, that's where I stumbled upon your work with some of your interviews and publications that you've done in the past while I was doing our research for voting in the blockchain. Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good, Brett. Thanks for having me.
All right. And you are coming to us live from Melbourne, Australia.
That is right. Yep.
Very good. For our listeners, it's 4 o'clock where I am, 9 o'clock in the morning for Jamie, maybe 10. So thank you so much for taking time out of your morning to speak with us this morning.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Welcome to the Sucks podcast. So we're going to be talking about blockchain voting. So we're looking at blockchain as a solution for voting, for voting security, as well as for voting adoption. And really, like, one of our primary drivers of this podcast and this episode, Jamie, is that we are identifying the need to broaden the participants in the voting pool, specifically in the United States, but I think this is a problem worldwide as well. So I thought I could start by giving you my sort of layman definition of blockchain for all of our listeners who may not be fully aware of blockchain, and maybe only are aware of it from some buzzwords and some media. So I look at it as a decentralized database to securely store data and confidently track changes and genesis of those changes, where they come from. Everything is stored on a token that can't be retroactively changed, only added to, quote unquote, securely. How'd I do? How would you correct me?
Yeah, pretty close. I think the token paradigm, look, it's obviously the vehicle for a hell of a lot of grifting as well as actual utility. Yeah. There's, you know, like every new technology, there's good and bad, and it usually starts out more bad than good. And over time, as the use cases mature, the real potential is realized, and you know, the cream really surfaces. So look, the way that I've typically explained it to give people a sort of practical example of how it works, thinking about the immutability and the security, because that typically is the most common question with any individual, especially in the context of voting, let alone things like Bitcoin. But how is it secure? How will my vote genuinely be auditable and immutable and irreversible and tamper-proof? And in a similar fashion, how will a Bitcoin transaction do the same? How do I know that, you know, my fraction of a Bitcoin is genuinely mine? It's not going to get double spent. It's not going to get stolen. You know, how can it truly be unique? And the way that I kind of approach the description of that is to use real world analogs and talk about, for example, two individuals wanting to transact with one another. Maybe Bob is buying something from Sue for the value of $10. Mm-hmm. And what they might do to achieve this is get together in a room. But rather than just exchange that $10, because Bob or Sue might be potentially a little bit shady and they want to make sure that the transaction is honored and one of them doesn't come back a week later and say, you never gave me that $10. And Bob says, yes, I did. I definitely gave you the $10. And Sue's like, I don't think so. So to mitigate against this, what they do is they get hundreds or thousands of their friends, their colleagues, their family members, and they get them together. They tell them all to bring some notepads and a pen. And this entire group of people witness the transaction in question. And all of them have a shared understanding of it now. And they all record basically the same thing, right? Now, if any of those individuals were to attempt to record something different, well, the majority would essentially outweigh any minority vote as it relates to what that transaction was. Yep. And after the transaction happens, they all go home. So after the fact, if a bad actor wanted to go and try and modify the reflection of that transaction, they'd have to try and basically do it in a majority fashion. But this means essentially breaking into all of these people's homes more or less simultaneously to change those records. So it's very, very improbable. You know, computer science says it's not impossible. And there are definitely exploits which can be applied to mess with this sort of stuff. But in general terms, in layman's terms, it's perfectly secure. but in computer science terms, it's highly improbable that it could be made insecure.
That leads actually to my next question. Brilliantly, which is the concepts of security, and do we have a shared understanding of even what that term means? I think a lot of people, you know, who aren't technologists or futurists might look at it as very binary. Is it secure or no? And if there's I guess my question is there a threshold of statistical significance that we need to adopt around the concept of security?
So when it comes to blockchain, everything everything that isn't native to chain, everything that isn't genuinely decentralized, Bitcoin fits that application. It's one of those use cases. But when we talk about applying any layer above that, we're introducing additional attack vectors and additional points of weakness, basically. So every time somebody has heard about, you know, the blockchain being hacked, what's generally happened is that somebody has had poor security around their private keys. Somebody has gained access to their credentials, been able to authenticate as them to basically transact on their behalf. So in not in an entirely dissimilar way as to losing your password or being phished or socially engineered. An exchange might have been hacked, so on and so forth. But the blockchain itself, the actual record of transactions, it remains uncompromised to this day. Now, theoretically, if you were to commit tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars worth of compute to these networks, basically attempting to brute force by taking over with a 51% sort of workload, you could cause chaos. Nothing that's insurmountably irreparable, but you could cause chaos. In a similar fashion, Ethereum is obviously this gone proof of stake. If you were to commit tens or hundreds of billions of dollars to the proof of stake network, you could potentially have a significant influence there, which disrupts things. But to this date, the blockchains themselves remain perfectly secure as intended. Yep.
And with what you described, if an event like that happened with that level of significance, you would at least know that it had occurred. And right. you could begin to trace, you know, the genesis of where that had occurred, and at least know you have a problem. And, you know, it would be irrefutable that there was an event that happened. So that in itself is a positive.
Yep. And so in that sort of situation, what happens is the network of good actors understands that there has been a compromise. And essentially what takes place is what we call a fork, right? So let's pretend for a moment that somebody committed tens of billions of dollars of Ether in a proof of stake context to the Ethereum network to more or less stop it, take it over, gain control. Well, that's fine because that network would basically become redundant very fast as exchanges and end users all say, well, that's not what we wanted. That's not what we intended. So at, you know, a certain block, we're basically starting fresh on a new fork. And the person who's attempted to exploit the network in that way has essentially lost tens of billions of dollars of Ether because it's no longer worth anything. Yep.
There you go. Brilliant. So when I started first hearing about blockchain, maybe 5-6 years ago, I was first pessimistic because of the applications and because of the media that I was consuming was really characterizing it in a very narrow pathway. And as I started looking at what practical applications are, I became more and more excited. I think voting is one. How about you? Like, when did you first start experiencing the blockchain? When did you start thinking about blockchain as a potential solution to strengthen voting?
Yeah, I mean, look, for me, the clear and immediate use case was voting, but my perspective was skewed because at that point in time, 2014, 2015, around the time that Ethereum sort of ICO'd, blockchain had already been around for 5 or so years, of course, with Bitcoin becoming a real tangible thing. But I was working on a not-for-profit democratic movement called MyVote, and MyVote had this idea that we would essentially put more policymaking decisions in the hands of the constituency on a policy by policy basis. So rather than waiting a few years voting in a party or a package of policies that the parties represented or purported to implement, and certainly instead of voting for politician personalities, which is unfortunately really what most people are doing, even in the developed West. The question was, how do we get people to have a say on what's affecting them in the immediate term? And this meant that we might be asking people to have their say every month, every 3 months, every 6 months, frequently, right? On the issues that are affecting them that matter. And so then the question was, well, how can we do this? Because polling stations and postal votes are slow and they're expensive. Logistically, they're a nightmare, and we can't expect people to be getting out of the home every month or 6 months to go and stand in a queue to vote. And then, of course, yes, there are security issues along with the cost. Postal votes are not inherently insecure, but we all see all kinds of silly stuff happening with them, even in this country, where they're left out in the rain or they're posted to the wrong address. These are edge cases in the big scheme of things. You know, they aren't necessarily election shifting, but they're suboptimal. And so, you know, how do we do this on the internet? And so, having been involved in this MyVote democratic sort of not-for-profit, and also having gotten into Ethereum around 2015, obsessed with the idea that these smart contracts, applying a smart contract, a programmable layer to Bitcoin in theory, you know, the power that that would have for the future of the internet and software was compelling. And, you know, as we described earlier, the nature of a Bitcoin or a blockchain transaction is that it's immutable, it's irreversible, it's perfectly secure, it's auditable by all. And these all seemed to me like great properties for a vote and thus a digital voting system. And so it was quite serendipitous in that I was working on this My Vote problem. Programmable blockchains had just arrived. And it's like, well, what if we retrofit a Bitcoin transaction, so to speak, in the form of an Ethereum smart contract? Yeah. What if we retrofit that to represent not an exchange of value, not a bit of currency, but actually a vote on a topic? Right. So over the course of 3 or so months, we built out a prototype, turned out to be the first in the world, and it worked. So, you know, something I'm very, very proud to have been a part of. Did a lot of traveling on the back of that, obviously going off to form Horizon State and attempting to commercialize the tech with government, with NGO, with large institutions, enterprise, even small and medium business in some cases, corporate bodies for real estate, a whole bunch of stuff. Did a lot of traveling, spoke to mayors from all around the world, and the reception was incredible. People were thrilled, but of course, especially in government, you know, this is like a 5, 10, 15, maybe even a 30-year play before we see it genuinely propagate and be adopted, which is fine. But, you know, I look forward as this continues to increase in terms of adoption and usage over time to have been a really important part of its you know, catalyzing period.
Wow. There's a lot to break down there. You touched on two things that I want to ask you about first, and then I'll tee up the next as well. You mentioned security. And, you know, as I look at security, I'm looking at it from a very sort of privileged perspective here in the United States, here as something that I referenced on the podcast too much, as a white male, 40 years old. I think about security differently. I'm in a privileged place of thinking about security. However, just the act of going to a polling place in some parts of the world for certain populations could be a dangerous or act of its own. So, you know, I think the blockchain could be a wonderful alternative to encouraging people to vote safely and securely from that standpoint, which is different than, you know, how I'd traditionally looked at security of voting.
Totally. That's a great point. That's a great point. And in fact, you know, I very, very quickly start to see it that way myself. The application of this technology and the solution we designed specifically meant enormous cost savings for the, you know, running of a democratic process in a developed nation. For example, the same-sex marriage plebiscite here in Australia ran over multiple weeks/months, if you include the planning and marketing, cost taxpayers 120 odd million. And indeed, there were a bunch of those issues with postal votes and so forth. So by using technology such as this instead, you're looking at $1 or $2 million instead of $120 million, like orders of magnitude different. But the cost saving for developed nations and the security that that technology affords, the process is fantastic. But then looking to developed nations, where indeed simply expressing your political views and going to places of polling can indeed be a life-threatening ordeal in some places, we really actually had the opportunity to protect people in whole new ways, about giving individuals the ability to participate in their electoral process remotely, actually improved safety and security. And so there was a genuine humanitarian benefit here. Obviously, in developed nations, there's also higher degrees of corruption and overt, blatant corruption as well, things like switching out ballot boxes or burning ballot boxes. And so again, by digitizing this, we are improving safety and helping erode the degree of corruption which does take place. Now, you know, we can speculate all we like about the degree of corruption that happens certainly subvertly in places like the United States and Australia, but there it's obvious. And this just has such a clear and incredible use case for improving safety for citizens and constituents, but also improving the quality of their democratic outcome.
1,000%. And moving on to cost. So in my research, you know, I found that, you know, in the United States, it the cost to cast a vote could be between $7 and $25 per vote.
That's right.
And the blockchain cost is significantly less than that. So that is another benefit for blockchain. By reducing costs, we can you know, increase efficiency. And I think that's just another incredible thing. Does that match your findings as well?
It does. Look, the cost per vote is obviously significant. It fluctuates. Obviously, we've seen super high transaction fees for networks such as Ethereum, as it relates to usage and a whole bunch of other factors. Blockchain in an optimal scenario should be costing cents to tens of cents for that kind of transaction. Smart contracts arguably higher. Of course, it has blown out to sometimes be 50 bucks, you know, for a transaction on certain networks at certain points. But this is still early days. We're still sort of figuring out scalability. Proof of stake is a big part of that as we lead on to different layers in these blockchain solutions to optimize for efficiency and cost. But in general terms, even right now, significantly cheaper on a cost per vote perspective. But then there's all kinds of other additional costs which you need to factor in, such as the utilization of physical venues, the human resources to run those, the security at those venues. So, like, absolutely, if you look at these sort of balance sheets, what it actually costs to run any kind of activity, you're talking about hundreds of millions of US dollars, both in places like the UK and the US, where populations are pretty significant in these centers. Not quite that expensive in Australia, but still obscene. You know, it just it's crazy. Yeah.
So my next question was meant to be theoretical, but I have a feeling you've already referenced that you have, you know, real world answers for what I'm about to ask. And that is, you know, how would you structure a blockchain rollout? Do you start small with pilots and expand from there? And it sounds like the answer is yes. I mean, but can you describe, like, how would you, you know, roadmap it to reach adoption and confidence in the blockchain as a solution?
Yeah, look, I think smaller pilots with smaller organizations or departments within institutions and government is absolutely the way to go. And we found that firsthand commercializing the Horizon State blockchain voting technology. So we ran some activity with some specific councils within New Zealand. We ran some blockchain voting with certain departments within Australian government, including South Australia. And we also set up closed pilots with nations such as Gibraltar, you know, very small countries so far as population is concerned, but a perfect test case. You know, they're wanting to innovate, they're wanting to move fast, and they can because they're smaller. A lot of the time, their regulatory frameworks enable them to move a bit quicker than big, you know, lumbering behemoths. So that's absolutely what is happening right now. And, you know, a quick Google search will turn up dozens of companies similar to Horizon State now, which I think is just super exciting. It's just, you know, it's obviously inevitable. It's just a matter of time.
Absolutely. I think the, you know, the media should play a larger part in this too, and really start to evangelize these stories as, you know, as they roll out in countries like Gibraltar, et cetera. So we become more accustomed to it. I think, you know, if you were to, you know, spring this on populations who are unprepared, they would have too many questions. I think that there's a large part of an educational campaign that is probably going to be required before we, you know, reach critical mass for this as a solution. Mm. What do you think?
Yeah, I think part of it's generational as well. It's part of the reason a lot of technologies make a good little dent in adoption during their first 5 to 10 years. But a lot of the time, we don't see revolutionary technologies really take hold for 20 or 30 years post, you know, their creation. Part of this is distribution, but also part of it is just simply generational. And it's about what is accepted without overt degrees of skepticism or cynicism. And so we have certainly an older generation right now, who most are on smartphones, mind you, most have sort of upgraded from their old Nokia feature phones to things like low-end Android smartphones, whatever's cheap and works for them. But they're not digital native, and there isn't a full or whole understanding about how these things work, why they're possible, why they're trustworthy, and that understanding continues to shift over time. I mean, you look at Gen Z, you look at Gen Y, the millennial group in general, and even Gen X's, and the willingness to understand it and accept it is in a different league to baby boomers. Yeah.
Absolutely. And to that end of understanding, you know, what I've tried to do is come up with a use case for how blockchain might have impacted previous elections and previous sort of, you know, conflicts that we've had relating to some of those. You know, one of the biggest ones in the United States history is we have Bush versus Gore in the year 2000. There is this recount in the state of Florida. While the recount was going on, it was essentially ended by the Supreme Court and Gore conceded, which I think was correct for democracy in continuity of, you know, democracy in the United States. However, you know, looking back, had, you know, that vote been on the blockchain, that recount would have been more efficient and probably more expedient as well. So when you do have contested elections, the blockchain would, I believe, allow for more expedient and secure recounts and inspire, you know, a different type of confidence. Even when we do reach recounts now, they're still fairly manual. I mean, sometimes, you know, in the state-by-state or county-by-county level, it's still people manually recounting and tabulating these votes.
Right. That's part of the cost, absolutely. It's why they have those cost blowouts. But the beautiful thing about a public blockchain voting system is that not only can it be recounted in near real time, but it can be recounted by anybody. You know, we establish processes to make sure that identity is tied to votes, not in a visible or transparent way, but in terms of building out that ledger with these transactions and making sure that we have processes in place at the start of that funnel to build trust around the idea that it is real individuals casting these votes. Right. And then at the other end of it, once this process has concluded, well, it's all there now. It's on the ledger. We understand the processes. We understand how this thing has come to be. And anybody can really be looking at that through a standard explorer and be running scripts and analyzing it, looking at this, counting it in real time. Yep.
And that leads to one of my next questions, one of my final questions, which is about sort of messaging and branding of the blockchain. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this. I've been putting some thought to it. And, you know, what I think is really empowering about this is that you can own your own vote. You can own your own vote would be like my central messaging, where I have the ability to track, validate, and verify that my vote, who I, right. you know, was counted accurately.
Absolutely.
Reflected throughout the system.
And that's a big part of it, right?
Really powerful message, yeah.
It is. It totally is. And we saw that with a number of the pilots that we ran here with the public, as well as people within institutions, more enterprise application. But the ability for them to cast their vote and then verify it, literally see it on the blockchain and understand the association. So, you know, it's still kind of a public-private key paradigm, but we aimed to hide that complexity from them in the user experience, but still having the ability to kind of have that account view, so to speak, through their voting application and be able to look at the votes they've cast historically and verify that they're still there and that indeed they're being counted. So it's very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It's like in one way, it's empowerment. But in the other way, it's responsibility and putting onus on the voter. So to me, they almost have a responsibility to go back and track those votes.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Jamie, I think that you are an optimist on this, you know, in terms of technology being a useful solution for improving the world. I mean, you reference like maybe this is 30 years before it's broadly adopted, but are you optimistic that we're going to get there and that, you know, we can improve voting as a whole through technology?
Absolutely. You know, the world is going digital. It has been for a long time. You know, software is eating the world. Everybody's familiar, especially over on the west coast of the US with Mark Andreessen's writing on this topic. Sure. I think, look, 30 years is me actually attempting to be conservative. I think it's going to happen sooner than that. And I think we're already seeing it. The application, in fact, is already being deployed in sort of narrow niche use cases, certain institutional use cases, shareholder votes, these kinds of things, body corporates. Yeah. This is all happening right now. And governments around the world have been looking at this very seriously for a number of years now, since the first conversations I was having with them back in 2014-15. And some of them already ran pilots. So we only have to look to countries such as Estonia, who have actually been running voting processes, democratic processes online for far longer than the blockchain existed. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, arguably has an intrinsic insecurity about it, which would scare the pants out of most democratic nations running these votes, and probably rightfully so. But the technology now exists to do that and do it right and do it well. And I think for the pessimists and the skeptics that I've had conversations with over the past years, most of them they're falling onto the position of, if it's not perfect, we shouldn't do it. And my perspective is that if it's better, we should do it, and we should continue to make it better. You know, perfection is an illusion; it's a mirage. The further you get down the road, the picture changes. By the time you get there, the point is, can we make it better than the status quo? It's never going to be perfect. There's always going to be pitfalls and concerns and considerations. But if on the whole, it's an improvement, it's a step forward, that's really all you can ask for. That's what we've got to attempt to do in perpetuity, is make things better and better and better and better. And the idea that we wouldn't take any action because it's not perfect, you know, it's strange how common that belief is whenever new ideas surface. It's not perfect, we shouldn't do it. It's I think it's counterproductive. But thankfully, the passage of time and a peer into, you know, the past suggests that thankfully those views very rarely win out, and progress is generally unrelenting. I mean, there are hurdles on the way and there's dips and hiccups, but moving forward based on technological process is almost, you know, it's what we are. It's part of the human condition. Our ingenuity, our willingness to invent and adopt and drive forward. Right. And people forget that the chair is a piece of technology. The wheel is a piece of technology. I think people like to, single out high tech. We don't even call it that anymore because everything is basically
it's a meaningless term at this point. Yeah,
right. You know, the media jump on it, individuals jump on it, but the bottom line is that the only reason we're in this position today is because of technology. And I think all in all, we're going to continue to become better as a global sort of people, as a global civilization over time.
Well, brilliant. I can't think of a better way to wrap up the conversation, but I do want to ask, where can people find you? And is there anything that you'd like to plug personally?
Twitter, intermittently, and LinkedIn intermittently, obviously just at Jamie Skiller for Twitter, and look me up on LinkedIn. But they're really the only two networks that I dabble in time to time at the moment. I've quietened down on social a little bit over the past few years. I've got a four-year-old daughter now, and life's priorities change, so I'm not quite as active. But I'm working on a few really exciting projects at the moment. The one that's taking up most of my time is indeed, there's a blockchain element to it. But in essence, it's a real estate disruptor to get more young people into the property market sooner so they can benefit from the capital appreciation sooner. And then there's a little esports play on the side, something called Checkmate. And then there's another crypto play, which I'm working on, exchange traded funds, ETFs. We're trying to build out decentralized versions of those, crypto versions of those. So yeah, having a lot of fun with side projects and that main gig, but come say hello if you want to chat about any of it.
Right on. Jamie Skella, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we have you back on the podcast soon. I hope you'll join us.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
That was awesome.
That was absolutely incredible. It was a really great conversation. Great.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was great, Brad. You know why? Because I know you guys were skeptical of online voting.
Yep.
I wasn't. I mean, I kind of was, but I'm a dreamer, you know, and I loved it. And I think online voting can happen. And that just proved it to me. That just absolutely 100% proved it to me. And it gave me faith in the future.
I guess one other thing about online voting, though, is the same thing about mail-in voting and other types of alternative voting. Is it not that it isn't safe? It's that it can be perceived as unsafe. It can be propagandized as not being safe, causing more and more.
Right. And that's why
I don't care. You know,
yes,
you're right. And it should. And we should get past all that. That's the big solution is.
Yep.
Honestly, we should have billboards that say voting is safe. Here are the stats. Like maybe that's what we have to
do. It's just a public education campaign. Yeah, it needs to be rock solid. We need to get better at info. We need to get as good at info as they are at disinfo.
Yeah.
And it's all about repetition. It's all about repeat, 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 beat it into the people's heads. And but first we got to get there. We've got to have a very secure, very transparent solution. Right. And as your guest said, that's entirely doable. It is doable in at least 30 years, if not probably sooner.
Totally. Well, blockchain is a way of making sure that you have historical record that is rock solid of the voting.
Exactly.
So I think that could be a first great step to those data stories. Wouldn't it be great if we said after an election, great news, guys, we had 97%
absolutely
confidence in this election based on
97% participation and confidence.
Sure.
Nice. You know, that would be the dream.
I see how I'm moving us along. Let's go into engagement.
Here's the thing. Like, you know, when we talk about analytics and we talk about data, this is where people don't have any kind of clear understanding of what we're talking about, like meaning the populace at large. Because you can talk about voting security and you can point to one dead person who voted in Delaware and that becomes like a talking point. That is not a talking point. That is not statistically significant at all. And that's what I want to get at statistical significance of voter security, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's always going to be 2%. There's always going to be 1% or 0.5%. It's probably like super low.
It's like 0.05.
0.001.
Yeah. So it's not sexy though, Brad, if everything went smoothly. Like I can't sell things on my news network if there's not this dead voter in Delaware. I mean, look, you even have alliteration. Dead Delaware voted for Democrats. See?
Exactly.
That's beautiful. Put it up. But how do we feel about compulsory voting?
How do you feel about compulsory voting?
I mean, look, if we want everyone to vote and that's the goal, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're always going to get the feedback that, oh, it's freedom. You can't tell me what to do. I understand that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm on the fence. How do you guys feel? I'm on the fence.
I'm anti-compulsory voting.
Yeah. Okay. Joe?
I, you know, just to split the difference between the two of you, I think you're right, Dave. I don't think we'll ever have it because, you know, I don't think this country will ever buy into, I'm told to do something. But they do it in Australia to some solid results from what I understand.
Yeah. Are all these solutions how to get people to care about voting? Don't be disenfranchised. You already said that. Okay, here we go. Here's a good one. Yeah. I want concrete stuff. Yeah. Election day, national and state holidays.
Hell, 100% yeah. For. Yeah. Hell yeah, 100% yeah. For.
And the only reason you would be anti this is if you don't want people to vote. I mean, let's be honest. People who are against this.
Maybe there's a capitalistic approach for why you wouldn't want another holiday in the middle of a week. But I think it's
not a Wall Street day off. Then throw it on a holiday exists. Throw it on President's Day. What else are we doing then but barbecuing?
Right.
So there you go. Yeah. Solved.
And why does it have to be a Tuesday? It could be a Monday.
Well, Saturday. I mean, have it on a freaking weekend. Like more people have flexibility to vote on a weekend.
That's true. We have an election. Some people do. We have state holidays every weekend. We have two of them, eight of them. We have eight of them every month. Put them on a freaking
Tuesday's
Saturday.
Probably the hardest day of the week.
Yeah, it's terrible. Right? But Monday might be worse.
There's probably some historic intention there about voter disenfranchisement.
Oh, man. It's on a Tuesday. I wonder.
Sucks podcast has solved it. Election Saturday is a thing. Okay,
so
moving on.
Paid time off to vote, right? How about half days that are sponsored by employers? A lot of employers do this now, but maybe we could incentivize all employers.
You could federalize it. You could do it. You can make a law about it. But I don't know. Do you want to put it on business owners? Then you're really getting people against your cause. That could just be solved by putting it on a Saturday. That affects no one. There's no cost to that.
But in a yes and approach, you know, until we, you know, really fix this whole thing, it's something that major employers could do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's something that, go ahead.
You're asking a lot of people to do a lot of things. This could be solved tomorrow. Like you could just go, voting is now on Saturday. It could be the president could say this, could just stand there and go, any president could say this. I don't know why they haven't. You just get up and go, hey, I think voting should be on Saturday. Use the bully pulpit and go. Why wouldn't you want it on a Saturday?
And for the entire month ahead of time.
So and then you just make it happen. Within 4 years as president, you couldn't strong arm everybody into making Saturday a voting day. There's no reason against it that I could think of. I mean,
I can't think
of
a good reason.
Everybody Google it and hit me on the socials if I'm wrong.
I just don't know enough about how elections are set up state to state.
I don't care, Brad. You know me. I just here's the solution. You figure out the details.
Right on.
To Saturday. Done. Right on. Okay, voter guide apps.
Okay, here's one thing that I wanted to mention regarding paid time off for employers. Like, I do have a large team, and when it does come to election days, I'm pretty clear to communicate. I want you to vote.
Yeah.
If you need time to vote, we're not going to put a barrier in front of you. So that's something that I do personally.
Okay.
Right.
And like, that's fair,
people
Brad.
Can do that. People who
I'm sorry, Brad. I discounted that solution, and you're right. I mean, I'm being pie in the sky. You're being practical. And you're right. You can encourage other business leaders to do the same right now. That's something that they can do individually. Right. Fair. Sorry for clipping your wings there.
and that's for people that work 9 to 5 in like standard. I mean, there's still a problem with people that, work at, they have the Saturday shift at the bar.
Oh, sure. There's always going to be that. But
So still, I think early voting still helps too. Like, we should just not limit it to one day, but at least have that one good, that one solid day. That's
Joe, you bring up an interesting counterpoint, because I was just throwing Brad a bone and saying, oh yeah, I'm sorry, but you know what, who's more likely to do that? It's going to be, to use Brad's terms, white guys in their 40s in probably posh offices and like white collar industries where you have a little bit more flexibility, you have some work from home situations. But you know what, the guy at the steel mill and in the mine isn't going to go,
retail,
come in whatever
food
you
service.
Want exactly. So you're then creating a situation where a certain portion of people are having more flexibility, and then other people are disenfranchising.
So it just
I take
has to
back,
be yes
Brad.
And. Like, the answer to all this is yes and. Yes, have Saturday voting. Yes, have extended voting. Yes,
more.
Have voting
more
windows
is more.
For more and more and more.
And I think
more is more.
And I three more quick things I think we should run through. I think we've got to get rid of money in politics. Mm-hmm. Like, the super PAC thing is horrible. We need to clean up our, like, election monetization and the laws around
Citizens United needs to be reversed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like I can give $2,000, but I can give $1 million to a super PAC. It just doesn't make any sense. No, right. The fact that there's all these like weird laws where like I can use super PAC money early, but I can't after a certain date, or I can only use individual contributions after I'm a primary candidate. Like, let's try to be clear about all of our like voter finance laws, all of our election finance laws. We should simplify that.
But Joe, that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
that's too pie in the sky, because you have a Supreme Court that put that in that only got more ideologically that way. So that's not going to happen.
Well, let's keep voting. The other thing I would, and you guys could debate me on this too, I think in Europe, there's a limited time when you could campaign. Like, it's short. It's like 8 weeks from the time you announce your candidacy to elections. Whereas this country, you know, people have already started running for 2024. For it's 18 months, not 18 weeks. And I think it's almost too long. You get a little bit brain fried after 18 months. Like, if it's fresh, if it's new.
I do like that they cut it off a few days before the election. So you can't be it's basically our, you said it earlier, electioneering. Mm-hmm. So it takes an electioneering, like you can't do it at the polls. It takes that and blows that up even more. It's like you can't, no radio talk, no like commercials, nothing. You just,
Yeah, that reminds me of a funny story. You guys probably don't remember this. You know, it was not a big deal. But when Hillary Clinton was competing against Donald Trump for the presidency, days before the election, you guys probably don't remember this. It was not a big deal at all. James Comey, the head of the FBI, alluded to like some weird investigation of Hillary Clinton. That was, I don't know.
That's hilarious. I don't remember that, Brad.
Did she have some boxes in her basement?
Are you sure? It was something like about butter. It was something about butter. Like, she had a butter company because they kept saying butter emails. Like, there's a tranche of emails about butter.
Butter emails. Yeah.
If she had margarine emails, we would have been fine.
These are better than my bee jokes. These are better than margarine.
These are much better than your bee jokes.
These are much butter than my bee jokes.
All right.
That was a non sequitur. So sorry about that. But, good times. That was fun.
All right, guys. So
that happened.
I would like to say we solved voting, because that's always a way to just shut us all up. Did we solve it, or do you guys have any more? Because I honestly, I think Saturday and the killer app, I think that's it. They're both my ideas.
I mean, along with the Matrix and Star Wars.
Information and access are two of the most important things.
There's one other thing that I wanted to talk about that I think is very divisive. ID voting restrictions and laws. Is that a good idea or a bad idea? Like, I think that there's
That's a great question, Brad.
Right?
Yeah.
I won't tell you what I think, but what do you think? Do you need to have ID to vote?
I've always been like, I know that my political ideology says that's terrible, and like certain people, certain communities are impacted by this. So yes, I'm against it for that reason. But what I don't understand is when I go to vote, my signature is there upside down.
Yeah.
And then I have to sign, and I look at them like, and then I sign, and then they compare the signatures, and I'm like, is that the most secure way to vote?
I don't think so.
Right. I mean, I guess it is, because your signature is unique, but so is your ID.
Right. But I don't show an ID when I vote by mail or drop in a Dropbox. So
good point.
But it was mailed to your house. And so technically that's the security. That's the encryption. It's door to door, literally encryption.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could go into your mailbox and take it. Mm-hmm. But then you could also report that you didn't get a ballot and they'll strike that one.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm going to go idealistic here and say no, only because the more limitations you put, it starts to become a slippery slope. Where do you cut it off? Yeah. But I think it is, I mean, idealistically, there is also the argument that you want to make sure the right person is. But again, we're going back to fear-mongering a little bit.
Yeah, totally.
The amount of fraud is so low,
right?
It's not even give it voice.
That's true. Good point, Joe.
That's a good point, Joe. Yeah. I was going to go the other way. I'm kind of for ID laws if you're going to vote in person.
Why? To solve
exist. For security, but you're right.
Solve a problem that doesn't exist.
To solve a problem that doesn't exist. But I think it's a losing argument. Like, there are some like hills that we choose to die on the left that I think are losers.
Mm. I mean, is it though? So you've got to look. I mean, and we obviously should have done a lot more research. Sorry, folks out there who are screaming at the radio right now going,
I know. If you look at the data of people who don't have IDs, they're marginalized people, they're immigrants, and they're people of color. I understand all of the statistics. And I guess that I would my response is that it should be pretty easy to get an ID. Right.
Okay, like, Brad, I'm on indivisible.org. Why people don't have IDs? Sure. For many Americans, an ID seems like an easy thing to obtain, Brad. Uh-huh. Everyone has one, right? Wrong. Think about it this way. The most common form of ID is a driver's license. A lot of people don't drive.
Not the only.
Maybe they live in urban areas like Manhattan, right? They take subways. I know a person I work with who is like in an office corporate setting has never had a driver's license. Okay.
Yeah. You can still get a state ID, though. I'm not talking about driver's license.
Okay. A lot of people drive. Maybe they live in urban areas, elderly, or can't afford driver's ed or a car. Okay. For those folks, driving is off the table. In some cases, people are working schedules that stop them from accessing the venues in which driver's license could be obtained. That doesn't mean voting should be off the table. Okay, let's talk about other forms, Brad, because I think that's where you want to go.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to come by. U.S. passports, military ID, government or private employer IDs, tribal IDs, student IDs, or gun or hunting license. In practice, that means if you don't drive, don't travel internationally, don't have a job that gives you an idea, and don't hunt or carry a gun, you can't vote in many states. And then you'll frequently hear the argument that Brad's probably about to make, that a person has to have an ID to drive a car or buy alcohol, so why can't we require ID to vote? Let's be serious. Driving a car and buying alcohol are not fundamental civil rights. Voting is. Mm. Okay, does that answer your question? Do you still...
I agree with all that, and I think that people should have IDs.
Yeah. Okay. I'm almost more on Brad's side now, because I think all of those have very easy holes in them. I mean, you could still get a state ID. We actually have a system of government cost. ID. It's called a Social Security card. It's
They talk about state IDs. They say multiple documents are required to get this quote-unquote free ID, right? And birth certificates, Social Security cards, citizenship papers, proof of residency. Many people do not have access to their birth certificates. People experiencing homelessness, to go back to that episode, Brad, frequently do not have these documents, nor do people who've experienced natural disasters, those who move frequently, or just aren't good at tracking paperwork. My hand is raised. So basically, maybe the pot is small of people, and not even small. There's how many people are homeless? There's, you know, so I think it's just another barrier. And if there was a lot of basically what you're talking about, Brad, I'm sorry, I'm totally stealing the mic here. I'll shut up in a second. Basically, what you're talking about is we're losing this argument because there's a perception on the other side of the aisle that this is something that they need because they've digested a lot of disinfo about how much voter fraud exists.
Yeah.
So basically, your argument is appeasement.
My only argument really is picking our battles wisely,
and
picking arguments that we have a chance at winning. Like I don't think us like trying to die on this hill is going to convert anyone on the right to come to our way of thinking.
Yeah, but you will also disenfranchise a lot of people who then will not get vote. There's a lot of people who are in certain communities very hesitant to get an ID of any sort, very against the government.
Yeah.
So those people you'll lose all of them.
What about, I've voted in previous elections where I wasn't registered or there was a problem with my registration and it was, what do they call it? Contingency ballots or something? Do you remember?
Right. Yeah, those are scary.
What is that called? Those are a little scary.
Sure. We'll call it that. But
I guess that's probably a terrible idea. Oh, or talking about is creating what we're talking about is creating a subclass of voters, which we don't want to do. So strike that. Okay.
Nope. But there is there's a solution to that too. I mean, actually, like day of registration that's another limitation I think people have put on, and I think that should be something that why is that so hard to do? Like, shit, I didn't register. I could go over to this table and register right now.
Yeah. Well, it's another. It's true. It's another step. It's something. Paperwork and it complicates slows it down.
I'm not saying you should do it that way. I'm saying that the option should be there. Like if you're like, oh crap, I didn't register.
No, I know.
You'll be able to.
I'm playing devil's advocate of why they'd be against it. Just the practicalities of and how it would slow the system down. Because you're talking about backing up. It's like if you're ordering tickets on Ticketmaster and you have your line in the queue and you suddenly got to create an account.
Right. You know what I mean? Sure. All you do is together. Say, go over to that table.
No, next. I know, but I'm saying you're making it easier than it is because then you got to file paperwork because things are not, and then you got to put it in a database and then you count the vote.
Right.
So, but I get it. I agree with you, but I'm just saying why.
Right. Well, okay. Back to the ID thing, and then we'll close this out because we're coming up on 3 hours, gentlemen, since we started recording this.
Two-parter.
Right. Let me close out the ID voting thing. It's like I just am saying that if we were to redesign this from scratch and had an even playing field, and if we were going to build this from the ground up, that might be a concession, you know, because I don't think that, you know, we would be able to get absolutely everything. Yeah. I would be willing to make that concession if we were going to build this from the ground up in a way that made sense.
I'd be willing to trade that if we can get more than a two-party system. Mm-hmm. That would be a huge thing too if we had
more
the way they do it in Europe, where you have to have a contingency. And
you got
to
build a government.
Yes.
We like Coke and Pepsi here, Joe.
Apparently.
Hey, man, I mean, there's nothing preventing a third party.
Why don't you ask?
Democracy doesn't demand it.
Right.
Why don't you ask Ross Perot and R.C. Cola how that worked out?
That's right.
R.I.P. Both of those.
Okay, guys. So all I got, right. Pie in the Sky and Voter Killer App and Saturday. We solved it.
It's yes and to all of it. Like, yes, more voting, less restrictions, more opportunities to vote, and don't lose hope.
Absolutely. And tell a friend, guys, if you have people in your family who want to take away voting rights, explain to them why it's important and explain everything we said and do some research and talk. Yeah. Talk to each other, folks.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. We have to solve our problems at the ballot. You know, we cannot solve them with violence. Anyway, so especially to our listeners who are in Ohio, who are in Texas, who are in Florida, who are in states in between California and New York, please vote. I don't care what you vote for. I don't care which way you lean, but you better vote because your vote really, really, really matters.
Yeah. Amen. Amen. Mm-hmm.
And that is our episode, 3 hours long. Hopefully we've whittled this down to an hour and 20. Good luck, Dave.
Thanks, Brad.
Please remember to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you could. It would really, really mean a lot to us. And in the meantime, we are wishing you all health, a well-designed life, good experiences, and happy voting.
We actually did start recording until 9 is actually only an hour and 45 minutes.
Holy fuck.
Plus whatever the interview you got to drop in.
Yeah, right. We're going to drop in an interview.
This is going to be a two-parter, fellas. Let's take a break.
I was going to say, if you're going to do it once, this might be the one because we could break.
Joe's so happy. Look at the smile. Look at his face.
Well, Dave, if you're...